The Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror!
Hello, escapees. I'm the Chris Keeper, and I'd like to apologize for the lateness of this episode. You see, this is the long-awaited Escape from New York episode. This episode is late because I've gone to much trouble and expense to secure a special guest for tonight. Mr. Christian Bale.
You see,
I've hooked him up to my special electroshock correcto table. Let me just pull this ball gag out.
The fuck are you doing?
Oh, I'm going to teach you how a real action hero talks. So shut up and repeat after me. Call me Snake.
No! Don't shut me up!
No, that's not quite right. Call me Snake.
I want the Joker.
I don't understand a word you're saying.
What don't you fucking understand?
Try this one, why don't you? My name is Pliskin.
Where are they?
Well, it looks like this is gonna take a minute. You guys just go ahead and go listen to the episode. I've got a little bit of work to do here.
Let's not take a fucking minute. Let's go again! Do you understand my mind is not in the scene if you're doing that?
Alright, welcome back to the Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror, and every time I have to really think to make sure I get that title right, even though I'm the one who came up with it.
Yeah, you and really have...
Well, go ahead.
I was going to say, you really have no one to blame but yourself.
I know. I always do it to myself. And the voice you hear is Luke Giaconetti, my co-host, Luke Giaconetti. There I go again, even though I know better.
Everybody gets my name wrong, it's okay.
Scott's been getting it right lately. Scott is very good at, like, embedding people's names into his head. I envy that simple talent. And we are missing the hair metal hero today. He is missing in action. We don't know what happened to him. Hopefully he came to no misadventures in Beantown.
Maybe he's fighting a succubus again.
I hope so. I hope so. I wish this was like a live radio show, because at least while he was quote-unquote fighting off the succubus, you know, he could still listen to us talk.
Yeah.
Yeah, gross. But hey, it's a double feature tonight. It's a double escapism, Escape from New York and Escape from L.A.
Yeah.
Double dose of Snake Plissken.
Yeah, and... Am I thinking correctly that this is the only sequel that John Carpenter ever did?
As far as I can tell.
Yeah, I mean, I know he's gotten credit on some of the Halloween sequels for, you know, characters created by or stuff of that nature, but I think this is the only sequel he's ever directed.
And all those Halloween ones were just sort of a, you know, sign-off, I'm sure. You know, this is a fully crafted Carpenter movie. I noticed that Kurt Russell's name was in the writing credits this time.
Yes, on Escape from L.A.
I wonder if it was you know, an active script writing thing, or if Kurt Russell was just sort of around, and then they'd put up a copy of the script and he'd go, I don't know, I think Snake would do this, or, you know, I think Snake wouldn't do that, or whatever. I'm not sure how that works. But it was cool to see Kurt Russell's name and John Carpenter's name on the screenplay of Escape from L.A., for sure.
Yeah, well, I do know that Kurt Russell has said many times that his favorite character that he ever played was Snake Plissken.
And really?
Yes, and that it was mainly his driving force that got Escape from L.A. made, because there had been rumors of a sequel to Escape from New York in the mid-80s, and Carpenter had said that the script that he saw was too tongue-in-cheek for what he wanted. And it was pretty much, you know, it was Kurt Russell came up with a lot of the ideas to bring Snake back and how to use him again. And so, yeah, I think a good portion of the script is him, for good or ill, you know. Because I think one thing we can say about Escape from L.A. is that, at least in the form it exists now, it's very derivative of the original movie. It's, you know, it's the same. I mean, the setup is the same, sure, that's understandable, but details are the same.
I would like to play the movies side by side. I was thinking about how can I play these movies side by side to see if he cut them the same. Because there's almost the same template of, you know, at the same point in the movie, in each movie, Snake just sort of like gives up for a second.
Yep.
Pulls up a chair and a rickety chair and sits down. And that's when, you know, his guide character shows up to,
yep.
you know, who will guide him through. And it all follows, you know, one. He meets up with a you know, tough hot chick, and then she gets pulled through the floor. Then he meets up with a tough hot chick in L.A. and she gets, you know, randomly shot just a few minutes later. So it's following that same template. And once I realized that's how it was going, you know, and it was doing an Evil Dead, you know, it was following
right.
the template of it and then upping it, you know. And instead of when they're walking through the halls, instead of putting you in a chamber that burned you up, you know, they were strapping people to electric chairs in the hallway and frying them, you know.
It's almost like, you know, it's like, oh, you want a sequel to Escape from New York? I'll give you a sequel to Escape from New York. I'll give you Escape from New York all over again.
Well, I have a theory about Escape from L.A. because every time I watch it, I start loving it just a little bit more. It'll never be as good as Escape from New York because it'll never have the serious edge of Escape from New York, you know? Escape from New York was, I look at it almost as like a forerunner of like the Terminator, where it was, you know, that gritty... But that was New York. This is
right.
L.A., baby.
Oh, yep.
It's completely different, you know? And it's funny, just about at the time I was thinking, man, if I got thrown in one of these prisons, I would much rather get thrown in L.A. than in New York City. And that's when, you know, the female character actually said, hey, you know, it's not so bad here once you get used to it. It's actually the only free place in America left. And I'm thinking to myself, all right, this script is pretty self-aware, you know.
Yeah.
They knew what they were doing. You know, there were moments of cheese that just surpassed, you know, my meter of cheesiness, like where Jaws attacks him, you know, outside of Universal Studios in the sub.
Right.
And just the whole sort of sub sequence where it's bouncing around and stuff. It looks very video gamey. And, you know, where he surfs up to Steve Buscemi and it's just like three layers of bad green screen going on, you know. That's budgetary problems.
Right. I would have taken either the surfing or the hang gliding. When we get them both, that's a bit much. I agree with you. You know, Map to the Stars Eddie has my favorite line in Escape from L.A., which is, hey, this town loves a winner.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I remember thinking... Because I had never seen Escape from L.A. before I watched it for this film, because...
oh, really?
This came out right before my senior year in high school, and I remember being, oh, I really wanted to see Escape from L.A. I loved the commercials. I always loved Escape from New York. And it was there and gone in the theaters in New York before I got a chance to see it, and I was so cheesed off. And then I remember reading how bad it was, and it's like, eh, I guess I'll just watch it eventually. And this is a movie that's never on cable, so I never ended up catching it. And I remember thinking as I was, you know, when I got it from Netflix, I was like, man, shouldn't this have been called Escape from Los Angeles? That would sound a little more serious. And now watching it's like, no, this has to be called Escape from L.A.
Yeah. You know, Netflix has got the Surgeon General in it.
My God, they're real. But, you know, so I enjoyed this too, because it's the same. Remember, we last episode we said that, you know, Jack Burton is kind of Kurt Russell doing self-parody.
Yeah.
The same kind of idea, I think, that Escape from L.A. is, in a lot of ways, is, again, it's the self-awareness of the, you know, because we're talking about the United States in the Escape series now has fallen into this theocratic, you know, right-wing dictatorship, and, you know, where all the undesirables are, instead of, like, in They Live, just bulldozed out of existence, they're dumped on this island. It's not like
prostitutes, atheists, and runaways.
Yep. It's not like Escape from New York, where it's violent criminals.
Right.
You know, but it's that, you know, it's the very reasonable slippery slope argument. It's like, well, you know, it worked so good in New York. You know, we got rid of all these criminals. Now we got to get rid of these. We got to take out the trash. And an interesting element that was in the original script that didn't make it into the final was that after the earthquake, it wasn't that they immediately just turned it into the prison. They make a point that in the narration, they make a point in the original script that the gangs took over the city. The existing street gangs in L.A. took over. And then, and so it was already no man's land. They said, we're just going to dump people there. So that's why I think it plays the way it does, where it's not like a wasteland like New York is. Because that was, you know, they evacuated all the regular people out and just dumped all the criminals there. Here, the gangs are running the same type of turf that they did before the earthquake.
Yep.
Every time they go someplace else, oh, this is such and such turf. This is such and such turf. It's like the Warriors.
Yes.
You know, everybody's got their own turf, and it's just one big gang war. So I was impressed by it. It has that kind of cynical L.A. attitude about it. It's cynicism taken to the most nihilistic extreme possible.
Yes, and I mean, I just don't understand why this movie wasn't. I guess I do understand, because it happens all the time that movies like this aren't appreciated for what it is when it came out. But yeah, it was the same sort of thing. And I remember I saw this movie in this now defunct theater that was infamous as being just like the theater of broken dreams. It was like when a movie played there, and they must have been really broke and could only afford like flops, because if a movie like this was in the theaters and out in a second, you know, in a blink, it barely even played through the first reel before like they just emptied out the place and tossed all the reels in the garbage. And so we got to catch it at this place, and you know, I mean, I was just, you know, enjoying myself all the way through it. Immediately I was just like, oh, okay, I see what this is going to be. This is just going to be fun. And I was along for the ride, and I thought it was just good, cheesy fun. And every subsequent viewing, I pick up more and more little details that jibe up with, especially after watching it back to back with the original, you know, the details that jibe together, and you know, the subtle differences between what cracks me up is now both of them are so outdated that when you see the dates on them and you're just like, oh man, and they're just like, yeah, and in 1997 when, you know, when LA fell into the ocean, and the same with you know, what was 1997 now in Escape from New York. It's just awesome. In 1988, the crime rate rose 400%, and it's like, geez, I don't remember that, man. That was 2 years after I got out of high school.
we're doing this backwards, talking about L.A. before New York, but you know, the absolutely, it's amazing to me the things that catch on. Okay, and it always comes back to being ideas that are, you know, that are so far ahead of their time that they don't necessarily hit big, but they influence people who know how to make money. And what I'm saying here is that you look, Escape from New York is one of the most influential films ever made outside of this country. If you look at the number of knockoffs, ripoffs, pseudo sequels, and wannabes to Escape from New York that came out of Italy alone, it's enough to fill up your Netflix queue to overflowing.
But that owes a lot to the Road Warrior too, because they were usually both of them sort of crossed together. All those Italian movies usually had a little bit of both in them.
And the reason that you can tell that these were, you know, that they were trying to cash in on Escape from New York is that Escape from New York in Italy was released as 1997 Fuga da New York, which literally is 1997 Escape from New York. And so there was this whole subgenre of these post-apocalyptic films that were named the same way, like 1990 Bronx Warriors and 2019 After the Fall of New York. And
yes.
So it's like yeah, and they're
seen
all
both
the,
of those,
and they're both pretty good movies, you know, for Italian
in their own way.
Yeah, but you know that the Road Warrior influence comes in because they're shot in Italy, so you can't really shut down sections of Rome,
right?
Like you can shut down sections of St. Louis. So they film them out in the country, you know. But, oh my God, I remember the first time I saw Escape from New York was on video. Just one day, I was going through my dad's movies, and there was this Escape from New York. I'm like, what is this? So I threw this on, and I was just captivated with this movie from the first moment. And this is one that, you know, a lot of times I don't like narration in movies, but this is a movie that does narration right. Because it hooks you on it and then goes away. It sets up everything you need to know, and then you're just along for the ride.
Yeah, and well, you know, and it was also before that sort of computer briefing that you would get became a cliche. You know, it was one of the first times you ever saw that presented to where it didn't look ridiculous or cheesy. You know, there was. I don't know if there was a huge budget behind this movie, but whatever was done with the budget for Escape from New York was done to a great effect because, man, it looked like a destroyed New York. It looked like New York had been destroyed, and then every night it gets a fresh layer of destruction. There was, like, you know, burnt out husks, but there was fresh garbage strewn, you know. It looked dangerous. It looked just like a dangerous place to even just step foot in for 1 second, you know?
Yeah.
You basically had to be Snake Plissken to walk through it alive.
And you know what's funny is that this is, I made allusion to St. Louis. This was a section of St. Louis that had been mostly destroyed in a large fire. And, you know, it was pretty much abandoned. And so what they did was that Carpenter and his crew came and shot here overnight, you know, for 10 weeks or however. And they actually convinced the city of St. Louis to turn off the electricity in this area overnight so that they could get it being all dark at night and such. And it's just, you're right, though. As far as looking authentic, you know, I mean, it's the urban hell of all urban hells.
Yeah. Oh, and literally, I mean, you could go into the whole Dante's Inferno thing with Cabby, you know, being his guide through, you know, when he goes through the theater and down into the basement where all sorts of perversions and and violence are happening, and everybody's got a little, like, every room has a little fire on the floor, you know, just pile of papers, and there's smoke in the air.
Yeah.
And it really feels like a dank, dirty, grimy, scary, fucked up sub-basement, you know? It does not feel like a set. It feels like a just completely evil place.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, I think that in a lot of ways, you mentioned The Terminator earlier. The other one that I would put with this film that as far as the other side, as far as kind of an inspiration, would be Death Wish.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Death Wish for a long time was kind of the knee plus ultra of the, you know, again, the urban hell with violence lurking around every street corner, and only someone who's armed and willing to do, you know, willing to go all out is going to survive in it.
The nerves of steel.
Yeah, and also helps for carrying a bag of groceries. But, yeah, so it's the same kind of idea. It's just that taken to the science fiction level. Here in Escape from New York, whereas that shot for a more kind of urban realism, you know. Which is funny because their politics are about 180 degrees apart.
Yeah.
I think Death Wish may be the most right-wing film ever made.
In America, you know.
Yeah.
I mean you know, you got Lenny Riefenstahl. That's about as far right wing as you know you're ever gonna get.
But for an American film, certainly.
For an American film, yeah, that's like the crown. Yeah, the crown jewel of like, well, that is a right wing film that will appeal to everybody. That will make even the most hand-wringing, tree-hugging hippie root for Charles Bronson to put a bullet in the racial stereotype's head.
and by the same token, Escape from New York is, you know, really beneath the surface, it's a leftist film. I mean, it's about the little guy who used to be part of the system that's not anymore, and he gets kind of railroaded by this draconian authoritative government that's all powerful, that throws him into this hell, and then just kind of shrugs him off at the end. So this is a film that even like I said, someone who leans to the right can cheer for this cynical nasty hero as well.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's the thing about Pliskin is Pliskin has no sides. His side is Pliskin.
S.D. Pliskin, American, Lieutenant, Special Forces Unit, Black Light. Two Purple Hearts, Leningrad and Siberia. Youngest man to be decorated by the president. He robbed the Federal Reserve Depository. Life sentence, New York Maximum Security Penitentiary. I'm ready to kick your ass out of the world, war hero.
Who are you?
Hauk, police commissioner.
Bob Hauk.
Special Forces Unit Texas Thunder. We heard of you too, Pliskin.
Why are we talking?
I have a deal for you. You receive full pardon for every criminal action you've committed in the United States. It was an accident. About an hour ago, a small jet went down inside New York City. The president was on board.
President of what?
That's not funny, Pliskin. You go in, find the president, bring him out in 24 hours, and you're a free man.
24 hours, huh?
I'm making you an offer.
Bullshit.
Straight, just like I said.
I'll think about it.
No time. Give me an answer.
Get a new president.
We're still at war, Pliskin. We need him alive.
I don't give a fuck about your war or your president.
Is that your answer?
I'm thinking about it.
Think hard.
Why me?
You flew the Gulfire over Leningrad. You know how to get in quiet. You're all I've got.
I guess I go in one way or the other. Doesn't mean shit to me. Give me the paper.
When you come out?
Before.
I told you I wasn't a fool, Pliskin.
Call me Snake.
He reads from the book of FTW, and for those folks who think FTW means for the win, think again. That acronym means something else in my world.
It's funny that you mentioned that because I actually was paying attention to graffiti on the walls, and because I'm big into like symbology in movies, and I've been watching this one guy who does videos on symbology and backgrounds in movies and stuff. So I'm always looking at graffiti and stuff, and there's lots of FTWs on the walls in Escape from New York. And at that time went to know to put FTW out. That was either John Carpenter was ahead of his time or he had some punk rockers on the set, and said, here's some, because that was at that point, that was like a total punk rock phrase. Right. And he'll begrudgingly save the life of a girl if he has to. If you're a guy, you're on your own. He don't give a shit. You could tell he had a little bit of empathy for Cabby, just because Cabby was such a fawning fan of him and did help him out.
But Cabby also abandoned him.
Yes, Cabby also screwed him. And that's here's a difference between the two films is if
Stars Eddie.
Map of the Stars Eddie being the sort of cabbie, he gets away alive at the end of the movie. So usually everybody, all the flunkies get killed.
The flunkies have some much better deaths in Escape from New York. Brain runs the wrong way. Cabby's cab gets blown up and he gets killed. Maggie gets run down. Whereas here, you know, Hershey and all her gang just pretty much get all burned to death like that.
Yeah. They're just taken out. But still, there's an epicness of having Pam Grier playing a male to female surgery.
Right.
And that voice did not appear to be dubbed at all. I wonder if that was Pam Grier, like, if that was Pam Grier putting a little testosterone in her voice, that was downright scary. Yeah. But that did not seem like a dubbed voice. If it was, somebody did a really good job in looping that. But that's the great thing about both these movies too is they're just chock full
of nuts.
Of character actors galore. My favorite thing in the world. I mean, you got Borgnine, Pleasance, Isaac Hayes, Van Cleef, Harry Dean Stanton.
Yep.
Oh my God! And then just biker gangs full of extras and weird punk rock, you know, people that don't look that weird these days, but boy, the one guy who is all theatrical, the Duke's number one guy there, he was really creepy back in the day. I remember the Starlog magazine coming out that had James Bond on the cover, and then it had like just, you know, one of the little inserts was him, and I was like, what? Ooh, this is John Carpenter's new movie? Is it a vampire movie or something?
And what's funny is that Mr. President from the first film, that's our friend from They Live, you know, who says, we all sell out every day, you know. I knew once I got this, they'd make me president.
Oh, that's right. Oh, my God.
Yep.
You're absolutely
and
right.
Another bit of trivia, the gladiator that Snake fights is the former wrestler Ox Baker. Whose quote was, "I love to hurt people," and was one of the innovators of the heart punch. I always wanted to bust the heart punch out against Pliskin. But it's like, Ox Baker, and apparently there's a story that apparently Baker was working really stiff, to use wrestling terminology. He was really kind of not pulling a lot with his hits, and apparently he hit Russell, like, in the back, like, real hard, and so Russell, like, punched him in the groin and told him to knock it off.
What I like is he's not the inventor of the heart punch, just an innovator.
He took it to new places. In all seriousness, Ox Baker did. Who was it? He fought somebody, and then they died. Like, had a heart attack later in the night, and the promoters used it and said, "Oh, he killed him with the heart punch." I mean.
Well, the guy who died would have wanted it that way, I'm sure, you know?
It was, somebody did the heart... Maybe it was... Ox Baker was really before the TV. There was someone who used to do the heart punch in the NWA where they would actually put, like, the big black censored bar over it when he would hit the guy, you know? That's how dangerous the heart punch is, you know?
Yeah, that way kids couldn't get the exact technique and kill each other in the school... schoolyard the next day.
but yeah, I mean, and then in Escape from LA, we got, you know, Steve Buscemi, and this is a Pam Grier, and just lots and lots of character actors here.
Peter Fonda.
Yeah.
How often do you see Peter Fonda in a movie at all?
And he was great.
Yeah. Well, he was. It was almost like Cabby got split between him and Steve Buscemi in that movie, you know, because he was the fawning, like, "Hey, Snake, you know."
Yeah, you don't want to go down
and
there,
I love
Snake.
That they surfing the tsunami, and you know, it just gets better. I mean, and these movies are so far, like, they have the disasters in them, but they have them wrong, you know. I mean, Escape from New York is totally anachronistic because he lands on the World Trade Center. But it's just, you know, that it doesn't hurt the movies. It makes them more fun. Well, it's just sort of weird always whenever you see the remake of King Kong and stuff, and you see the World Trade Center, it's just weird. But,
and of course, who can forget Bruce Campbell is in this movie.
Oh, Oh yeah, and Bruce Campbell, every time he has a is not a lead role, he's just in the movie for too short a time. Yep. You know, you just want more. You always want more of him, and he was just. I mean, the character, you could have done a whole movie around the character of the Surgeon General and his religious cult of plastic surgery victims around L.A. That's just brilliant, you know. Ridiculous, but brilliant, you know.
Interesting bit of trivia. Did you know that Kurt Russell and Bruce Campbell have both played Elvis Presley?
That's true. They did. One played the young Elvis and one played the Elvis in his... in his twilight years, which is a show that I'd like to do sometime. I would like to do that movie sometime. I love that movie.
You know, talking about being ahead of its time, and you know, the opening to Escape from New York with the skyline of Manhattan and all that.
Yeah.
Modern viewers may not realize, but that's not CGI.
Oh, that no, was, not yeah. in those days.
No, but it's not even like early, like Tron era CGI. It was. Or even going back a bit further, it wasn't like, you know, CGI like the grid lines in the black hole. That was done just by shooting live-action plate, and then, oh, what'd they do? They like, masked it and painted it the bright colors and pulled the masking off and everything. It was very low-tech, but man, does that not look like CGI, like 1980s-era CGI?
Well, you know what? It actually stands up better tonight than 1980.
Yeah.
It actually was a little higher res because... it was filmed that way, and so it actually looks like something you might see through like a imaging camera these days, you know? Yeah, I noticed that too. I love in Escape from New York all the shots of either, you know, the computer imagery or just the shots of the city, which was probably a model, you know, and the glider fly. I love the way they would, you know, intercut the clean lines of New York City where it's like, oh, it's New York City, and then you would see a cut in the real world outside and it's just in ruins, you know. You would see the real version of it, and it was all in gray, you know, nighttime with no light, electricity, gray tones.
Yep.
It's awesome. It's so atmospheric, and you know, it's one of those successful... why it's such a successful movie is it's one of those movies is it creates a world that is just really interesting and intriguing and puts you in it for not enough time, you know, just runs you through it so you get an idea of what it's like.
Yeah.
And those are the best kind of movies because they just want you leaving. I've always, you know, I don't go to like Renaissance fairs and shit like that because I just think I would hate it and I would want to punch somebody by the time I left, you know, that oh, good sir, blah, blah, blah. It's just like, yeah, shut up. But what I've always wanted, maybe some crazy, you know, Donald Trumpian sort of guy, is to buy off a whole section of New York or some urban city, and maybe this can happen in the future as the economy tanks more. Buy off a whole ruined section of city and build Escape from New York world.
Yeah.
Where instead of like going to the Renaissance fair, you get a group of people together and they throw you in there and a, you know, a cab will drive up, hop in guys, and it'll be like a minivan or something. Hey guys, playing the American Bandstand theme, and you know, we're going to go get some dinner, but we're going through some danger, and you know, and you drive through certain areas and people come out, boom boom, beat on the cab, and like the cab breaks down and you have to run through a base. It would be awesome.
Yeah.
I want it so bad.
Yeah, it's like Westworld, but it would still be pretty awesome.
It would be better than Westworld because I love post-apocalyptic, you know. I would love to actually like run around in a post-apocalyptic world. I cannot believe that they have not made a Grand Theft Auto type video game based on these games yet.
Right.
I mean, the movies are almost like a grand, you know, you're given an assignment at the beginning, you're given weapons, you got to, and you know, it's broken up into, you got to go here and do this and do this. Oh, now they got this and you got to chase after this person. It could be done so well.
Right. Oh yeah.
Why? Where is it?
I don't know. You know, one of the things that's always been very impressive about Escape from New York to me is that after the prologue, where that's, believe it or not, despite what some people want to tell you, that is not Jamie Lee Curtis, that it's Deborah Hill doing the prologue, the movie is go, go, go. You know, we're dumped right into the story, and Snake shows up, and then the president goes down, and we are gone. We are off to the races, and this movie never stops. Even the scenes that are supposed to be those quieter scenes, it's like charging forward. It amazed me how fast. Every time you watch this movie, it's like, wow, we're an hour into this already.
Yeah.
It's like, we're an hour into this. And it's like, and then you're like, holy crap, we're just about done. You know, it's whereas, you know, a lot of movies, especially in the 80s, this wasn't uncommon. They kind of they take their time getting going. Carpenter's films never are, and this one really doesn't. You know, we've argued back and forth over, you know, what might be the favorite Carpenter film or whichever. But I think that Escape from New York may be the prototypical John Carpenter film.
Yeah?
It's got almost just about every one of his elements in it. It's got, you know, action, suspense, a really strong score, a strong high concept. Kurt Russell is in it. You know, character actors galore. Kind of a leftist attitude, an FTW cynical attitude to it. It's like this is
the music,
right? This is exactly. It's the little references, the little background stuff that you might not.
Well,
even...
you had Cronenberg and Romero both name dropped in it.
Yeah, it's like this may really be the, you know, if you want a prototypical John Carpenter film, this may be it. Which makes it appropriate that it was revisited.
It's in the running for as one of my favorites. It's hard to say because it was in that time period where HBO, I saw it on HBO, and it was just like there was just like a plethora of Carpenter movies, so it was just one added on, you know, on top of another. So it's hard for me to decide, but you know, this is one of those movies that I consume it with joy. Every second. And I mean, when I was back in film school and we had to take directing the actor class, our teacher at the time was, you know, when we would, you know, it was a drama class, we would act out scenes and stuff, and he was a big method actor, you know, and or into method acting, and he would say, you know, the most important thing with any character is what their you know, they have to have a motivation to do whatever they're doing. And I mean, Kurt Russell is given the most primal motivation. He's put strap a timer onto his arm, put two bombs in his blood vessels that are going to blow up after a certain amount of time if he doesn't do what he has to do, and let him go. Yeah. You know it's not going to go on too long because he only has, you know, a limited amount of time. So, And I've always hated the countdown timer in a movie as an element of suspense. But man, it works! It works in both of these movies.
Yeah,
more so in the first one, you know, there's a nice twist on it in the second one.
Yeah, well, the thing is about the countdown clock here is that, you know, John Q moviegoer says, okay, well, they're not going to kill the hero, so he'll make it.
Right.
And then right as we're thinking that, as they're making their run across the bridge, they kill all the heroes.
Yeah.
And it's like, whoa, you know, oh crap, they might kill Snake. Snake might throw the president over and then die or something like that. And, you know, you're watching, it's like, is Snake going to make it? Is Plissken going to make it off the bridge alive? Because it's like, this movie is so downbeat. It's like, I wouldn't be surprised if they did kill the hero.
When you see the hand stop the winch going up,
yeah.
I remember when I saw that thinking, well, that's it for him.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to be... And I was raised on lots of 70s dystopian, dark ending, you know, Soylent Green is human movies. So, you know, I was like, okay, this movie could very, very well end like this. And, of course, it's all the more satisfying when it does, you know, when it doesn't. But
yeah. And the only complaint to have about the little countdown... Is it 22 hours or 23 hours? There's all these little goofs about how much time is left.
Yeah.
Unless it takes him an exorbitant amount of time to get him prepared. Because he looks at the clock and says 22:59. And then Hoyk says, in 22 hours, the conference will be over. It's like, well, is it 22 hours or 23 hours? How much time do I have here? And there's a similar type of miscommunication with time in Escape from L.A., which I guarantee you was on purpose at that point, you know?
Yeah.
But
I
go on.
I liked how it was a virus that they infected him with in Escape from L.A.
And yeah, she just scratches him with it. Because he's like, because it's true. He's like, you think I'm going to be stupid enough to let you inject me with something? He's like, oh, we already did that.
Yeah, we already got yeah. And you know, it was in the future. So they were, I mean, you know, they weren't fucking around with Plissken this time. They were like, you got the feeling he just didn't have as much respect for Stacy Keach as he did for Lee Van Cleef.
No.
So you know, they presented themselves as holograms most of the time. I love the characterization of the president too.
Yeah, it's good.
In that movie, when the earthquake hits and everybody, you know, sort of stabilizes, they look down and the president's the guy under the table, you know,
yeah.
Under the table and praying and just like, he's the one freaking out, you know.
That's one of the most damning bits of politics in either the movie. The theocratic president who, you know, predicts that it's God's wrath that has wiped Los Angeles off the map is the cowering, craven, you know, coward.
Well, both presidents in both movies are just cowardly, you know.
Yeah.
Donald Pleasance, I mean, nobody plays craven,
yeah.
Quivering, abject terror like Donald Pleasance, you know. The whole, you're the Duke of New York, that's just classic.
I was really hoping at some point he would bang his fist on the desk and yell that, you know, the Duke of New York is the ultimate evil, but unfortunately we did not.
And you know, I mean, how many movies do you get to see Donald Pleasance in a blonde wig too?
And that was that was his own idea.
Was it?
Yes, he came up with it.
Well, it's great because you can see the humiliation in him with having the wig on, and the second his hands are free, he just whips that thing off his head. He was giving himself a little motivation, but oh my God, he's just so. He's one of my favorite character actors. He always just brings that weirdness to it, you know, whether it was in Halloween or just anything he does. But this is an especially just like quivery, weaselly, just awesome, you know. And I love that, you know, that. Basically, you know, the way Plissken just tests him at the end, you know, I want to know how you feel about all that, you know. A lot of people died, you know, to and then I'm thinking about it, I'm like, wait, Snake Plissken's moralizing over the people who died in New York? They were just about everybody except for Cabby, and Cabby did screw him over too, but he ended up saving him. But everybody there was pretty much a bad person in one way or another. It's not like a lot of good people died to get the president out of there, you know. A lot of, you know, Snake Plissken would have, you know, Snake Plissken had no problem with his people dying. Why should he have a problem with the president being concerned whether they live or die or not? But, you know, that's just a minor quibble.
You know, I want to ask you a question here, and because I thought of this, and I had never made this connection before. When he goes to find the president in, the Duke's at the rail station, he turns and the guy shoots the crossbow at him, and he kind of dodges it a little bit, then shoots the guy, or hits, throws him with the knife. The first thing I thought was, it's all in the reflexes.
Yeah. That was another neat little scene. Because that was another example of the president just being an idiot where, you know, Snake gets in there totally. He's in there, you know, when the president notices what's going on, Snake already has the guy's throat slit and is quietly putting him to the ground. And, you know, Donald Pleasant just obviously mugs and stares and, you know, gives Snake away to the guy there who then shoots him in the leg.
Yeah.
And, the president would have gotten a punch in the jaw for that. Next time, you know, next time don't look at me when I'm saving your ass. But both of these movies have awesome soundtracks.
Yes.
Awesome, you know, the first one gets points for originality. Eventually I'm going to make my band learn the Escape from New York theme because it's just one of those easy driving, awesome. It reminds me of your, you know, European scores, you know,
yes.
Just with a very simple synth line, and it just works. I always, when I was younger, I used to think that stuff was really cheesy, and now it real, you know, now I prefer it over.
Yeah.
It's like now I'm a fan of the Goblin soundtrack on Dawn of the Dead rather than the American soundtrack version.
And Escape from LA, I think it's points for, you know, being a modern soundtrack with all the hard rock and heavy metal on it, but they're good selections.
They're so good selections, and he mixes them as if they were coming out of speakers
right. Somewhere
there. He doesn't mix them into the soundtrack as like a blatant plug for, hey, these guys are on the same label as, you know, the company that's releasing the film. It was very organic, and it added to things. It made it sound like you were in an outdoor festival type setting.
Yeah.
And man, a lot of hot chicks get sent to LA.
Oh yeah, well, all prostitutes, you know. And plus
very healthy prostitutes, you know.
Well, but plus it was all, but also, I mean, it was all the glamour pusses and everything that were in LA when the island was destroyed too, you know.
That's true.
So how
That's
many of
absolutely
them
true. What am I thinking?
Had to become prostitutes.
That's what am I thinking? Yeah, that's absolutely right.
And you know what's interesting about the earthquake is that I really dig the effects, the special effects of the earthquake itself.
Those at the very beginning?
Yeah.
Oh my God! It's like they spent all their money on those effects. You know, by the
those are some of the most complex effects ever in a Carpenter film, and they're in the first 3 minutes.
yeah. It's like, and I was watching those, going, "Geez, when this came out, these special effects are pretty seamless. They don't feel too CGI at all, because they're definitely CGI."
Yeah.
The scene of the wave coming in over the coast is beautiful, you know. It's done really well. And yeah, I think they spent a lot of money on that, and they didn't have as much left over to do the surf and the tsunami scene, it seems. or they couldn't do it with CGI, or it was a combination of both, but it was very cheesy. But it reminded me of going to see, when I went to see Army of Darkness, had a lot of retro blue screen looking effects and stuff, and I enjoyed it for that. This not as much, you know. That took me out of it, and the gliders took me out of it.
Right.
Because just how long can you keep a glider in the air when you're 15 feet up? You just can't keep circling like that. Yeah. You land.
And when you're firing automatic weapons too.
Yeah, these guys are just flying around in circles shooting automatic weapons. And I swear to God, when I saw this in the theater, there were a lot of, like, really bad visible wires. And I don't know if maybe they fixed it or something, but I haven't been able to, all my subsequent viewings after the theater, I've not been able to spot a single wire. Every time I see a wire, I realize, no, it's just, you know, part of the rigging of the thing. But I swear to God, when I saw that in the theater, I remember one scene going, oh my God, that's just, it's almost as bad as a boom mic, you know, in camera. But
like I said, I can deal with the surfing or the gliders, but not both, so.
Yeah.
I tell you, I really wish I had seen Escape from LA in the theater, because I remember you know, my buddy Bob, he was always up for going to see something if I wanted to see it, and we were over at his house, and he lived pretty close by the Jefferson Valley Mall in Lakeland or wherever that is in New York. And there's a movie theater at the JV Mall. And that's where we go to see a lot of stuff, because you always get dropped off at the mall when you don't have a car when you're in high school, you know?
Right.
And I was like, oh, we got to go see this Escape from LA. And he's like, okay. And it wasn't playing, and it drove me nuts. I'm like, okay, well, maybe it'll be here next week. It'll be here next week. And then I stopped seeing commercials for it, and I was like, crap. But, you know, if I had seen this movie in 1997 as opposed to 2011, I'm sure that I would freaking love this movie. Because if when you're 16, 17, this movie's like, fuck yeah.
It's candy, yeah.
I mean, especially...
Well, this movie was setting up... I want to see Escape from Cleveland. There were all these references to Cleveland. I'm like, oh, man, is there going to be an Escape from Cleveland? That would be fun.
Well, the third one is supposed to be Escape from Earth. That Earth will have gotten... That after the events of Escape from L.A., where Plissken, you know, really just flips off the entire planet.
Right.
That it's become basically like the new Barbarians, you know? It's really become like Mad Max.
And they're like, we're sending you back to Earth, Plissken. Yeah. And then he's going to have to make a run across the continents. Yeah. Give him some sort of vehicle, and he'll end up in Europe. I'm down. I'm down for it. I think Kurt Russell's probably still could pull it off, you know?
Yeah, because in that time frame, he could. What's funny is, I remember I saw an interview with Kurt Russell that originally, I want to say, was done on like IFC or one of those types of channels that does that type of programming is what I'm trying to say. And they said, oh, well, what do you think about the fact that they're talking about remaking Escape from New York? And without missing a beat, Russell goes, well, I'm too old to play Snake now.
Very Shatner-like of him.
Not even, you know, not a pause, not a joke, total deadpan. It's like, wow. See, I always thought that if you're going to remake Escape from New York, you get Kurt Russell to play Hawk. You play the Lee Van Cleef role.
Oh.
You know, like, you listen to me, Snake, and you get, you know, I don't know, whoever the tough act young guy to be opposite him. I'm big on that.
Good
on
luck
that sort
for that guy.
Yeah, I know, to be opposite Kurt Russell.
Or just to try to fill his shoes, you know.
Yeah.
What's really funny is they call Kurt Russell retro in Escape from LA, and when they dress him up, he still looks retro. He looks like retro 90s.
Well, what's neat is when he shows up at the beginning of Escape from LA, that's his costume from Escape from New York.
Yeah.
I don't mean that they recreated the costume. That's actually the clothes he wore in Escape from New York, and they still fit.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure he kept them. It was, you know what? His tattoo got better. The tattoo makeup got better. I wonder how many people have gotten the Snake Plissken tattoo, you know, since this movie's been made. You know there's got to be a lot of those floating around.
Yeah. Actually, you know what's funny is that... with the snake tattoo, it makes kind of a goof in the Italian version in 1997 Fuga da New York, because the character's name, snake in Italian, is serpente, or serpiente, I should say, serpiente. And serpiente obviously has a lot more syllables than the word snake. So what they changed his name to is Aina, which is Italian for hyena. So it's Aina Plissken, because Aina has the same number of syllables as snake. So he's got this guy's name is Hyena, and he's got a big old snake tattoo.
Yeah.
But that's Italian cinema. It just doesn't matter, you know.
You could, there's a hyena tattoo somewhere else.
Yeah.
One thing about Escape from LA that I wish maybe they would have had some more budget for was the Happy Kingdom on the.
Oh, the
on
Happy
the
Kingdom
water.
By the sea, yeah.
By the sea. Yeah. It was that was lost on me on my first viewing on it. And this time I was like, oh yeah, that's right. This is the only thing that they can't actually name that for real is Disneyland. That makes sense. But man, with a bigger budget, could you imagine the set piece that could have been done if they really, you know, basically it was just sort of a showdown in the opening in the sort of, you know, So it looked like a just beat up Magic Kingdom, but you know they could have used the monorail. They could have used.
Well, remember this is California, so there is no monorail. It's not. I mean, Disneyland, especially when this film was made.
Well, this one had a monorail track around it, since it wasn't Disneyland. When they show the above shots, there's a monorail track right around it.
But it's not. It still wouldn't be like Disneyland like that.
But it would have been.
They got the People Mover track going around it.
Yeah.
I just love the gag where they're flying when they're in the chopper and they fly over the Matterhorn. That cracks me up every time.
Yeah,
I must have replayed that about three times. I'm like, yep, that's the Matterhorn bobsleds right there. I've never been on the Matterhorn. I've never been to Disneyland in California. I mean, I've only ever been to Orlando, but it's like, is that the Matterhorn? Like, there's a track on it. It must be the Matterhorn. the Happy Kingdom by the Sea, except for, I mean, if it hadn't been for, I keep wanting to say Nice Guy Eddie, like which is Reservoir Dogs instead of Map to the Stars Eddie. If it wasn't for Map to the Stars Eddie saying, oh, that thing in Paris finally bankrupted him, which is such a 1997 joke.
Yes, yes.
I don't think I would have put two and two together at first, but once he said, oh, it's Happy Kingdom, Paris bankrupted, I'm like, oh, they're going to Disneyland.
And I love that he got caught in New Vegas, Thailand.
Yeah.
That makes perfect sense.
Yep.
I heard that and I'm like, all right, that fits. And I love that he was called a gunfighter in this. And he actually had, we're going to do Thailand rules or Bangkok rules, That was awesome. He assumes it. And I'm like, oh, he's assuming his gunfighter stance, So we get a little glimpse of Snake's job in between the two movies.
Yeah. And, talk about Disneyland. It would have been great. Snake Plissken, you just saved the president's daughter and, sent the world back to a prehistoric era. What are you going to do?
I'm going to Disneyland.
Yeah. What? And then another loose end that doesn't quite fit with this. He turns off all the power in the world and the president's daughter is saved from being electrocuted. And she's like, oh, I'm saved. Yeah. It's like, well, what's stopping them from taking you out back and cutting your head off, at this point?
Yeah. Well, in the original script, something, again, that was cut for budget was that after Snake takes out all the technology, they talk about that the invasion is happening, but the original script actually showed it. So where the United States police force is very quickly overrun by the forces from Los Angeles, and there's war. World War III has actually begun, and Snake just walks off smoking a cigarette into the foothills. I've caused World War III. I don't care.
And what a John Carpenter moment is that he finds a cigarette and the cigarette is lit up. In that close up where you hear the sizzle of the flame, it's like that is poison to anybody who's ever quit smoking cigarettes. As a cigarette smoker and often smoker and quitter, when you go to a movie like that and you've just sat 2 hours through a movie and then at the end of it the hero pulls out a cigarette and draws through it and it crackles at the end. It's just, you could tell John Carpenter loves his cigarettes. It's just like, here's my fuck you to I can't smoke anywhere.
And it's American Spirit cigarettes too.
It's American Spirit cigarettes, yes. And John Carpenter might be in his politics very left wing, but when it comes to political correctness, he's definitely not a adherent to political correctness or not, non-smoking. He's definitely not on that end of the the liberal spectrum.
I think with Carpenter is that his liberalism, and again this is presumptuous, I'm not speaking from any position of authority, I think it dates back to the 60s more so than kind of the reactionary PC bedwetting liberalism that we got in the 90s during the Bill Clinton era is what I'm thinking. There's very little I feel your pain in characters like Snake Plissken. His attitude is that, the government's fucked up and we need to fix it, which is, again, gets back to the whole counterculture movement of the 60s where a lot of this is informed from. It's just now in the, looking at these through the lens of the 80s, it's taken to its zenith, because what that group of counterculture folks thought was wrong in the 60s was taken to beyond the pale in the 80s, And so I even though I don't agree with it, I can respect it. And I think that's one reason why a lot of times political filmmakers kind of turn me off, whereas Carpenter, it's just like, no, I can buy what he's selling in this.
Well, he doesn't throw his politics in there to hit you over the head with them. He throws them in there as subtext, and they aid the story. They aid the story, and if you know, they're more on the satirical side, you know. They're not preachy or
because even
like
everybody comes off looking bad. The only person who doesn't look bad in Escape from New York is Snake Plissken.
Yeah.
You know, because who is it who takes out the Air Force One? It's a group of lefty terrorists. You know? And it's
he portrays them as clowns too.
Right, they're goofs. They're clowns.
They're stereotypes, yeah.
And it's the same in Escape from LA with the revolutionaries. It's like he's Cuervo, what is it? Cuervo Jones?
Yeah, he's
nothing but a street punk.
He's a street punk who has a lot of charisma,
right.
But I love the character, the president. You know, that's a perfect character. You know, the president's daughter who's rebelling, and she gets in too deep. And then, you know, the minute he just shoots the guy for missing the basketball shot, you know, she's done. You know, she's like gone too far, and she's thinking maybe I'd be better off back in Kansas right now, or. Where did they move? Was it Lynchburg that they moved the capital to? Or
yeah, it was in Virginia.
And and you can see the look on her face, and it's just a great little you know bit of acting. I like that character.
I like that character, and I really like that scene in the LA Coliseum. I think that's some really good location work there, because you know the LA Coliseum was designed to look like the Roman Coliseum. So taken out of its modern trappings, taken out of, you know, say the Rose Bowl or, you know, the Olympics or a modern sporting event and given back to gladiatorial combat, it looks so perfect. But at the same time, you still know it's the L.A. Coliseum.
I love that in L.A. when you know, in New York, when you fight for your life, it's in a boxing ring with bats with nails in it. In L.A., you play basketball.
Yeah, although they had the gladiatorial fights going on too. Snake does the shoots hoops. At first, when I was watching that, you know, you see all the fighting in the cages and stuff, and then you just see the one guy shooting baskets. I'm like, oh, okay, it's LA. Of course, there's one dude shooting baskets. And again, interesting tidbit. Kurt Russell, all the shots that Snake makes, Kurt Russell actually made them. There was no editing. He didn't necessarily make them all in a row, but he actually hit all the shots. That's why they're all in frame.
Did he make this insane long shot?
Yep, he made the full court shot.
Really?
Yeah,
I would have sworn that was... I always figured that was just a CGI.
I've read several places that he practiced and, you know, worked out and made sure that he could do it because he didn't want to look, you know, cheesy. So he wanted to look like he was actually shooting the baskets, including the full length. But I was like, that's impressive. The three and the half court, those are hard shots for an average person, but they're doable. The length of the court, that's a tough shot.
And that shot, the over-the-shoulder shot of it is just... And it's funny because that sort of foresaw... There was like 10 years after that, there was this huge spate of viral videos of people doing full short... court shots that just, you know, that was like a big thing on the internet for a while. It's like, look at this full court shot, and it was almost, you know, presuppose that it was almost the same angle. And so it was, it's funny because I had watched Escape from LA not too long ago, like within the last 2 months, and I was planning just to sort of skip through it and you know, get back up on the details of it to get notes for the show together. And I ended up watching, you know, from beginning to end, the whole thing, you know, just going, oh, wait, no, this is too fun. I'm going to,
well, you know, it's like when I was watching it, I remember thinking, you know, this is really kind of derivative, but as I got more and more into it, I really enjoyed it. And now I want to watch it again, you know? And you know what my favorite bit in all of Escape from LA is, my absolute favorite bit, is when he's getting outfitted with his gear and they're going through a hologram generator, you know, tracking signal and all this stuff. He goes, stick matches, just regular, ordinary stick matches. Never know when you're going to need them.
Yep.
And then, sure enough, he needs them to light the Molotov cocktails. I'm like, of course.
And his cigarette at the very end.
Yep, and stick matches. I love it. Because it's the only piece of non-technology he gets is a stick match. I'm like, that is perfect.
And it's and his only reward for the whole thing is a cigarette. Through the whole movie, that's all he gets is a cigarette. I just realized we never see Snake Plissken eat or drink.
Nope. Nope, never. The only thing he consumes is nicotine.
Maybe he's like John Carpenter. I get the idea that that's what John Carpenter's like. He's one of those scrawny, beef jerky, biker type of guys. You know, subsists on Jack Daniels and cigarettes. Classic old school director style.
You know, another bit I thought was amusing. Remember we talked about in the Mouth of Madness episode that when he goes to the movie theater at the end, the marquee is all lit up and all
yes.
that. Well, when Snake goes to the theater, I love that the marquee is still there. There's no lights on it, obviously, because there's no power. But the marquee has the name of the show, you know, everything on it. I'm like, that's great. That because you know that to me sells. Part of a line from the prologue where she says, you know, there are no rules, only the prisoners and the worlds they have made. And it's like, well, you know, if you're going to put on a Broadway-style stage show, of course you're going to put up the marquee to advertise your show.
You're gonna make do with what you got there. And what's
yeah.
funny is there's so much stuff, like, you know, just that's little glimpses you get of the world that say so much about it. And that's a great one because yeah, it's very much like prison. There's people there who are still, hey, we still like show tunes, the show must go on, and they dress up in wigs and women's clothes. It's like, yeah, there's not many women here, so we're gonna have to dress these guys up. You know, it's prison, so put a wig on him and he'll play the girl's part, you know. And We know how that goes in prison, but this,
right.
you know, it's portrayed as a stage show in here. But that pretty much says, yeah, there's people here in New York, you know, there's a good, it's a fairly normal thing to have very butch kind of fat bearded guys dressed up in bloomers and wigs and singing show tunes, you know.
Shoot a cop with a gun.
And it's entertaining enough that Cabby comes across town to catch the show.
To catch the show, yeah. Even though the show's a little later in a bad neighborhood. And Cabby's not just enjoying the show. He's, like, enthralled. He's
yeah.
like, just... I love it. He's almost borderline, you know, mentally disabled.
Yeah, it really... I always wondered, was Cabby a criminal? Or was he just there when they locked off the island and forget to leave?
I got the impression
that for 30 years.
I didn't get the impression that he forgot to leave. I had the impression that when they were closed off New York, he's like, I'm staying here, man.
Yeah.
It's me and my cab. I plan to die in my, you know, I plan to drive my, you know, I've been driving my cab all my life. Why do I want to do something else, you know?
Yeah.
I'll just drive cab in New York, you know. What I wonder is and another thing I love is the Duke's limousine.
Yo, with the
chandeliers on it. And that was so outrageous when that movie came out, you know, when he's all pimped out and stuff. Now, the way, like, pimps are portrayed and stuff, the limousine with my ride, you could see that, you know, somewhere. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if there isn't a rap star who's like, yo, man, get me one of those Escape from New York pimp cars, man. I want the, you know, that you can't drive more than 3 miles an hour because the, you know, you get bust up the crystals, man.
Yeah.
And you know, and Isaac Hayes's, like, pimp garb in this is subdued compared to, you know, what we're used to today. So, I mean, yeah, and you know, I forget, you know, how much further back in time that was, and you see, like, Isaac Hayes, and that guy is in shape, man. Isaac Hayes was at the top of his game in that, but then as soon as he opens his mouth, the first thing you think is, chef!
Now was,
oh, children!
Hey, children. Now, Isaac Hayes has a cameo in Escape from L.A., I believe.
Does he?
Isn't he the guy who opens the gate at the basketball court for Snake?
Oh my god, I have to watch that again. I think you're right.
Yeah, because it certainly looks like Isaac Hayes if it's not him.
I'll have to watch that again. Even better, I'll watch the credits.
Yeah. And what can we say about Adrienne Barbeau? Shit. Cool. Man, she is a good looking woman.
And just great script writing, because there's so much, you know, at first you get, you know, she first meets Snake and she's like eyeballing him and stuff, and Cabby's like, yeah, the Duke gave her to Brain, you know, because he likes him so much and all that, and you're like, oh, okay, I see, you know, she's like the Duke's way of controlling Brain. But then as it goes on, you see that she's, you know, she and Brain have genuinely built a relationship, you know, and you know, have quite a complex relationship, and she's loyal to him now, you know, even though she was given to him by the Duke, and she's obviously, you know, a strong person. She's not just, you know, a passive person. So that was and Harry Dean Stanton, you just can't go wrong with him. And I swear to God, you know, I want to live in Brain setup. I would love to have, you know, the New York City, you know, an abandoned New York City library as my home. How awesome is that, with an oil well pumping in the basement? Yeah. It's so cool, man. I want that. I love the, you know, Mad Professor hideout, and he's got, you know, an awesome one.
Yeah.
And the one thing in Escape from L.A. that didn't make any sense to me is how Map of the Stars Eddie's car stayed so nice.
Yeah.
Nice. Well, it was Cuervo's car, but
right.
I was watching it going, man, there's not a speck of dirt on that car.
Yeah, that's a good point, because everybody else's car looked pretty crappy.
Yeah, well, all the upholstery on it's white, like pure white. And I love the scene where Kurt Russell gets hit with the tranquilizer dart and it's going into black and white, and he's just, you know, fighting to get his hands around Eddie's throat, and Eddie just like brush his hand away and be like, anyway, Snake, blah, 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 blah. And the gun would come up and he'd just like, put the gun down. I love that. It's weird. It's like so few directors, when you see something that stylistic in a movie, most directors would just make things go fuzzy and a little foggy and stuff. But John Carpenter did weird black and white jump cuts and stuff, and I just love it.
Yeah, I you know, and actually of all the characters in Escape from L.A., I really like Map of the Stars Eddie, because for a while you think, okay, he's going to be like Cabby, but then he really just, he sells him out, and he's your typical L.A. sleazeball.
Yeah.
You know, he's always looking out for himself, he's lying to everyone he talks to, he's like, I like this, a good character, you know?
He knows everybody.
Yeah.
He shows up and he's like, hey, it's me, you know, and hey, good to see you, you know?
Yeah, and then he starts talking like, he's talking like an agent, you know, he's like, I love your work, I'd love to represent you too.
and coaching, I like what he's like, you know, they get into Pam Grier's place, and he's like, all right, Snake,
let me do the talk.
There's a weird scene here, and it's like, I don't know if there's such a thing as a weird scene for Snake Plissken at this point, you know, in his life. And just more of the formula, you know, he meets up with somebody who screwed him over.
Yeah,
and you know, if there's a third one, it's just going to be the same,
right? And it really kind of needs to be.
It might as well be the same formula. They might as well stay consistent.
Yeah, it kind of needs to be. You know,
well,
it kind of.
Harrison
needs to be.
Ford can do Indiana Jones movies. Kurt Russell can do a.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Charles Bronson wasn't exactly a spring chicken when he did Death Wish 5.
No.
The movie is better than it has any right to be.
Well, Death Wish, in that era of movies, of action movies, the star was always some like 55, you know, pushing 60-year-old guy, tough guy, you know? And I always watch those and I always like wonder, Don't these guys, I know they're tough guys and something, but they're getting, Walter Matthau was like a leading man dating 30-year-old women into his 60s in movies, and he looked like it too, but back in those days, that was like leading man age, it was in the distinguished years, and it was just always weird, to see that. And as the, as the time goes by, it just gets younger, characters get younger and younger and younger, and skinnier and skinnier. Action heroes all used to be sort of like, Charles Bronson wasn't like a muscle guy or anything like that. He was just sort of a tough, grizzled looking guy.
Right. But, all I'll say about Death Wish 5, lest I get on a Death Wish tangent, because I do love the Death Wish films, is I am aware of two films that have Death by Cannoli, and this is, it's Death Wish 5 and The Godfather Part 3, and Death Wish 5 is a much better movie.
I have still not yet seen Godfather 3. I'm afraid to watch it.
It doesn't really take anything away from the series not to watch it. It doesn't add anything to watch it. So.
Yeah, I heard if you just watch it as a movie, you can enjoy it. But if you watch it and expect anything near. I watched Godfather 1 and Godfather 2 like on two separate nights when I was in high school, and it was like a religious experience of filmmaking watching both of those. So, yeah, it would have to be pretty damn good. But with Death Wish, you don't have to hit those levels. There's levels that you do have to hit and get them right.
Yeah, pretty much you gotta have Charles Bronson mowing down punks, and that's.
I've only seen Death Wish 1, and
and
there's a couple Dirty Harrys that I haven't seen either.
Hey, well, you're in luck, because on AMC this week is Can't Get Enough Dirty Harry. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah. For when we're recording this, it is Sunday, April 17th, and all this week on AMC. Not that it helps any of you people listening to the podcast,
exactly.
But they're showing all the Dirty Harry movies, and usually when they show the five Dirty Harry films, they very soon after show all five Death Wish movies. So,
Dirty Harry primes a pump, and Charles Bronson.
Those folks who read our board, which is available at www.forumforgeeks.com, go down to the Two True Freaks section, will know that I often put over Death Wish 3 as the greatest film ever made, and I'm not bullshitting you. This is a fucking amazing movie.
Not being ironic or smart ass.
No, I mean, I could watch this movie all day. It's like, it's not my favorite film of all time, but this is just amazing. As far as action movies go, this is one of the best films ever made, because it's like, you want an action movie? You want a movie with Charles Bronson mowing down punks? We're going to give it to you for 90 straight minutes.
That's why you're on the show, man. You are the champion of movies that have I don't know if that movie has no champions, but you're a champion of Orca.
You gotta love Orca. Hi, Scott. Don't be mad at me for talking about Orca again.
It's okay, we're not talking about it on the Logan's Run thread.
Yeah. I had to laugh when you guys did the you and Joe Anthrax did the show about Let the Right One In. And he mentioned that, and I'm like, yeah, I know. I talk. Whereas you didn't help talking about White Buffalo on the same thread, and then we got up this weird tangent. Went kind of like we're doing now.
Yeah, it's almost an eventuality these days.
Hey, tangents, they're what's for dinner. You know?
That's exactly. And so, what now? What movie were we talking about doing next? Was it,
Well, because we had done Big Trouble in Little China, and then we did Escape from New York and Escape from L.A., so the logical one to that would be to do the last of the non-horror action movies, which is Assault on Precinct 13.
Oh, good. Oh, yeah, that's right. Oh, which awesome. I've also only seen that once, and I loved it.
Oh, Assault on Precinct 13 is just a classic. I didn't see that I ended up picking that up. There was a movie gallery, which formerly was known as Movies, in Clemson, South Carolina, where I went to school. And I picked up a copy of Assault on Precinct 13 when they went out of business. And oh my gosh, this movie is so good.
And to make it even easier, folks, if you want to watch it, this movie is available, Watch Instant, on Netflix. So you can go, you know, make a couple of clicks and watch Assault on Precinct 13 right now, if you really want.
Now, and also make sure you watch the John Carpenter one, because there's some people who just won't know the difference, and they'll go, oh, Assault on, and they'll watch the remake. Which I saw the remake. I remember going, that's not too bad. It was a different story.
Yeah.
It dropped out of my memory almost instantly. The only thing that really stood out for it, I remember it kept to the anyone can die at any time, and it had John Leguizamo in it, who I always I think he's a great character actor. I think he's always entertaining. When he's always like one of the most entertaining parts of whatever movie he's in. So I was glad to see him, but yeah, you can't beat the original. And if the other one had made more of an impression, I might be like, hey, let's do a double show on the two of them. But nah, screw it.
It's not like a situation like with The Fog, where the remake is actively terrible.
Yeah,
the remake of Assault on Precinct 13 is a fine little action movie. You know, if you catch it on
HBO.
They could
have given it a different name, and nobody would have known the difference.
If they had called that, you know, something different, I probably would have. I said, no, that's pretty good. That's kind of like Assault on Precinct 13, but kind of modern take. You know, it's to me, it's the same as like the remake of Dawn of the Dead.
Yeah,
I don't dislike the remake of Dawn of the Dead, but that's not Dawn of the Dead. If you had called that, you know, if you had called it, whatever, a different zombie movie.
Zombie Mall or
something.
Zombie
Mall. If you had called it Mall of America, like the board game, you know, MAUL of America, I would have liked the movie.
But just reminded me of something that actually brings me back to Escape from New York real quick. And I almost ran out and got it before the show, but I didn't quite have time. Out in my garage, I've got the, I believe it's TSR, Escape from New York role-playing game.
Nice.
I was actually selling board games to a coworker of my roommate at 4 o'clock in the morning a few months ago, and we were in my garage going through the stack of board games, and then I was like, "Oh shit! I forgot I had this. I have to bring this inside," and I haven't.
Oh man, that's cool. I've seen like images of that. I've never actually seen the game.
It was a lucky garage sale.
Yeah.
Garage sale find. It was one of those things where it was like, it's. I could probably sell it for a pretty decent amount on eBay, but it's one of those things where it's like, I'm never going to run into another one of those in my life. I'm keeping that sucker.
Hold on to it, right?
Yeah, you don't run into much Escape from New York paraphernalia.
No. But, so any closing thoughts on Escape from New York and Escape from L.A.?
If you haven't watched them out there, you must go watch both of them now. I mean, if you've been listening to the show by this time, you know that goes without saying. But, yeah, both movies, Escape from New York, will never get old for me. Even though there's a million anachronisms in it, it'll never feel dated to me. It always feels prescient, actually.
Yeah.
And Escape from L.A. just gets better. It's not the movie Escape from New York is by any degree, but it gets better and better each time I watch it, and it's a fine, fun, entertaining movie. I think John Carpenter's in full form in it, and Kurt Russell is definitely having a riot.
Oh yeah, you can definitely tell that Snake Plissken is Kurt Russell's favorite character, because he just. We mentioned the last time that what is Kurt Russell but a character actor with leading man looks? Well, he doesn't get to show off his leading man looks in this, so he is full-on character actor badass in these movies.
Yep, he treats every line, you know, he utters every line with full conviction and awesomeness and pure, Escape from New York sort of established it, and Escape from L.A. sort of parodied it, but you know, I mean, there's that element of like parody of like the steely Clint Eastwood Dirty Harry character, but boy, he's just the character of Snake Plissken is, I can't get enough of him. I wish there'd been a million. I wish he'd escaped from just about every major city in America and many major European and in Asian cities too. Escape from Tokyo would be great. Tokyo would make a great prison because it's an island.
Tokyo would be a great prison. You know,
Japan.
And you know Godzilla would probably be there too.
Oh my God.
I hear you got a big lizard.
Bring it on. Bring it on, and then we could meld the Earth Destruction Directive show and the Vault of Starling Monster Horror Terror into one awesome sauce of a show.
I don't think the planet Earth could tolerate that.
I was just going to say, I don't think the universe is up for that much just fucking awesomeness at once at this point. All right, well, we'll be back with next time with Assault on Precinct 13, and hopefully we'll have figured out what has happened to the hair metal hero in the interim, and he'll be back to shower us with words of wisdom, to wait for just the right moment to say just the right thing, like he did so well. And we'll see you then.
Take it easy.
Did you know you can sponsor an episode of this or any other of your favorite Two True Freaks affiliated shows? That's right. Simply click the PayPal link on our website, donate any amount at all, tell us which show you're choosing and what message, if any, you'd like us to read on your behalf, and you will be an official sponsor of that show's very next episode, with your message read in the show's opener. It's that easy, and there is no minimum donation. Be a show sponsor today. Visit our website at twotruefreaks.libsyn.com. Two True Freaks is always spelled TWOTRUEFREAKS. Libsyn is spelled LIBSYN.
You can email Two True Freaks directly at twotruefreaks@gmail.com.
Join our forum at forumforgeeks.com, where you can discuss all of the shows on our feed with us and your fellow listeners.
You can find Two True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for Two True Freaks.
Dumbass.
And hey, you can friend me, Scott Gardner, on Facebook too. My name is spelled ScottGardner.
You can friend me on Facebook too, if you can find me.
Now available, Two True Freaks t-shirts. See our website for details.
Two True Freaks is a very proud member of the Comics Podcast Network. You can check that out at www.comicspodcast.com, where you can hear our new episodes when we put them up.
We are also members of the League of Comic Book Podcasts. For more information, visit comicbooknoise.com/league.
If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about Two True Freaks? Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.
Do you ever find yourself going to Amazon.com and buying some record or movie or some stupid thing that Two True Freaks have been talking about so that you can catch up on it, or you've been reminded of it or something? Well, now, how about this? Instead of going to Amazon.com, go to twotruefreaks.libsyn.com and follow our link to Amazon.com. When you do that, if you buy something over at Amazon, we get a little cut out of it, which is awesome because we love money and it won't cost you a thing.
This is hell, this is fate. Now this is your world and it's great. What did I teach you?
You are Duke of New York. You're A number one.
I can't hear you.
You are the Duke of New York. You're A number one.
Two True Freaks has been brought to you today by Damanzo Core of Milan, Italy, and by the letters F and U.